Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. There's been a lot of these follow-up stories on the German airline pilot that committed suicide, took everybody down the plane with him. And also, of course, on the cop in South Carolina. And one thing you notice, and this is almost inevitable when you see people act a certain way, especially with people who are, you know, the school shooters, the serial killers, those type of people, when they ask the neighbors about them, when they ask their, well, not always when they ask their parents, because their parents, such as they are, don't really know these people very well, or maybe are responsible for the way, in some ways, that they behaved, although you can't blame everything on parents. Anyhow, neighbors and friends, teachers, describe them as loners. They say so-and-so was a loner, or he's a loner. He always acted like a loner. And it's almost inevitable that you see this with these people. Now, I don't think people are loners by choice. I'm a bit of a loner. In fact, I'm too much of a loner for my own taste and for my own, you know, mental health. But I've done the best I can with my loner personality by being on the radio. I've been over this many times, you know, being in a booth generally by myself, or maybe in a soundproof booth, sometimes as an engineer in there with me, depending on, you know, whatever station I've been in or where I've worked. But most of the years I was on the radio, I was in a booth by myself and had the controls. And I guess you could call that being a loner. On the other hand, I was in communication with a lot of people. So is that being completely alone? Yes and no. Same as when I was up on a stage. I was completely alone up on the stage and felt alone, completely alone. And yet there's people right out there. I mean, I worked in a lot of small theaters and nightclubs. And there were people within, you know, if I leaned over, I could touch the people in the first row. And I always had trouble with what was called the fourth wall in performing. Fourth wall, you know, somebody's up on a small, what they call a black box stage. There's just the left side, the right side, and the rear of the stage. Front of the stage, obviously, is open. That's where the audience sees you. There's no wall there. But it's called the fourth wall because there's a kind of an artifice. There's a wall there that you have to break through to join and to meet with the audience. If you don't break through it, the audience doesn't really get what you're doing and you don't really connect with them. So I used to start, my radio shows and start all my performances when they were live being alone. I would, first of all, I'll be in the green room or waiting in the wings. I mean, sometimes it was just a little closet or a part of the stage behind curtained off with a chair, you know, and you could just peek in. And these are small places, a lot of them. And you could just peek and see the audience. Or sometimes there was, if it was a big enough place, like I worked at the Village Gate once, giant nightclub. And they had a separate room, you know, where you hung out behind. And it's like a lonely trip. You know, you're hanging out back there by yourself. And then finally you go out and it's like walking from darkness out into the bright sunlight. Although it's odd. Basically, the room is lit up, but you're walking out to a dark stage with the spotlights on. But it's like changing your entire environment and then connecting with people. There's nothing smooth about it. It's pretty extreme. But these people who are the school shooters and the people who go into theaters and shoot everybody up, and I don't know how it works with if people have ever described, maybe I haven't read the stories enough, some of the people who are these suicide bombers, people who have left their sometimes middle class existence in England and other European countries and gone over to fight with the Taliban or ISIS and become suicide bombers. I don't know how how they were described by their neighbors or their friends. But people who live inside their head, people, now I don't think anybody chooses to be a loner. I mean, people are naturally social. I think people are naturally social. There's a lot of animals that live only in pairs, you know, that they mate or they swim by themselves. Sharks mate for life. They're, monogamous. But there must be, you know, there are probably some animals that basically spend a lot of time on their own. But human beings, like a lot of other kinds of animals, like I think it's dogs or wolves, cave animals, human beings are really, I think, basically social. And how does a person become a loner? You don't get a little choice, like a menu and say, I'll be, before you're born, says, I'll decide to be, I choose to be a loner. Nobody chooses to be a loner. I think we all feel, and probably with some justification, that anybody who is a loner or becomes a loner is somebody who was brought up a certain way and by parents who either neglected them or abused them, probably neglected them. If you spend a lot of time when you're a kid alone and you're not paid attention to by society in general or specifically by your parents or parent, you develop a very rich internal life, which if it crosses the line becomes a kind of insanity. You know, you rely on your own judgment of the world so totally that it becomes completely irrational sometimes. And then if you act out, so people are described as loners. And I think a lot of people, Europeans have come to this country from the old world. And it's a smaller, you know, these are Europeans came from ancient cultures compared to the United States. And the United States was a new place. D.H. Lawrence came here. Alec de Tocqueville came here. Charles Dickens came here. Other writers over time, over the last couple of centuries, have come here and described what they saw as an American leaning, kind of a, you know, and they can't include all Americans in this, but a certain, a lot of them went out west, or a lot of them went places where to them it was a little wild. And they described Americans as people who seem to choose to be alone, people who want to get away. If there are a lot of people who emigrated from the old world, came from very crowded cities. A lot of people came from very crowded cities, ghettos, from places that were very stratified, very culturally tight-knit. And they came to this country, a lot of people, to have space, which they didn't have in the old country. And I suppose this goes not just for Europeans, but for other people in other countries. They came here to have some space for themselves, more space and more choice to be whoever they were. And then they settled. A lot of people settled in what was, you know, what was to them the wild. I mean, you know, in the woods, off in the prairies, out west. When they first came here, you know, even Western New York and places like that were considered to be, you know, the wild. And people went off by themselves sometimes. A perfect example of what I'm talking about is, and I don't remember the name of the movie, but Robert Redford played a mountain man. Where, do you remember this movie? Since I don't have communication like I used to have, an instant sort of communication with my engineer, I can't remember. I can't get little cues from people like I used to. But I forget what the movie was called, but he was a mountain man, and there were people, and this is an extreme case, who chose to live off by themselves. And there have been people, I suppose, in every society, ancient societies, Eastern, Western, Middle Eastern, who have chosen to live by themselves. But basically, when we're talking about a loner, in this particular case, we're talking about somebody who is seen as someone who is different than everybody else, and maybe not in a very, very, very good way. I mean, somebody who presents a danger, somebody who is, you know, way off, somebody who is not normal. It's frowned upon. And in a lot of cases, people, you know, regard these people as, like I say, as dangerous people. But I guess it all depends on, you know, your environment, like I said, but it also depends, I guess, on the way you're born. Some people, I mean, you know, right, for yourself and for other people, some people are more or less social. They're just born that way. And I think everybody wants to be with other people, but some people seem to need it more than other people. They seem to need it more than other people. There was a famous psychologist, or was he a psychiatrist, named Carl Rogers, who wrote many books. And one phrase he used, which is perhaps his most famous phrase, is something called unconditional positive regard. And this is the ideal for raising children, or for what a child could get. There's some water here. Unconditional positive regard. That's, in other words, it's love that's given to a child. It's love that you give to a child, or that's given to you as a child if you got it, more or less. But of course, it's the ideal. There is no such thing as unconditional positive regard. It's just love without a price tag, is what the man was talking about. You don't have to perform. You don't have to be mommy's good boy. You don't have to be daddy's good girl. You don't have to get, 95 on every test. You don't have to, sit up straight all the time. You don't have to be the perfect little child. You don't even have to, be exactly what your parents seem to hope you were. You're just you. You're just you. And unconditional positive regard is love given freely without any price tag. And if you get this, and of course, like I say, it's the ideal. If you get this, you take this into your adulthood, into your later years, into your teen years and college years and your adulthood, and you can handle being alone better. You can handle loneliness, and you can handle being alone. And you can handle even solitude, which may be imposed on you. I mean, I think there's solitude which people choose and they need, And then sometimes there is a solitary confinement, for instance, which is imposed on people. But there is a difference between alone and lonely, I think. There's a difference between alone and lonely. Some people, when they're alone, are inevitably, they feel lonely. They feel like they're on the moon or floating out in a dark sea all by themselves. But some people can be alone and feel perfectly confident and happy to be alone. They have a certain self-valuation inside. They have a self that they can fall back on, I think. And so it's impossible, in a way, for them to be alone. I mean, this is, unless, of course, it goes on too long or it's an extreme of some kind. As far as for me, I think both my parents were loners. My mother was alone inside her own mind. She was seriously, you know, disturbed, mentally ill. And she spent a lot of time, you know, in her room by herself, sometimes with the door closed. But probably since she was a child, she was alone inside her head. Now, why this happens, you know, she was born a certain way, or, you know, maybe she was brought up a certain way. I don't have a home movies of her life when she was a child. I don't have, such things didn't exist then. And nobody has that, you know. How did somebody get to be like that? But my father, and same thing, I don't know exactly the way he was brought up or how he, you know, what he was born like. But my father was a real loner in a way. He could travel all over the world by himself. When he traveled all over the world and he lived and worked in foreign countries, and he stayed by himself. He didn't live with anybody else. He wasn't in a dormitory with anybody. Usually he was the boss. And he had an apartment in Istanbul. He had an apartment or a hotel room in France, in Paris, in Southeast Asia, in various cities where he was. He could live by himself. He could commute home from whatever, you know, project, like he was building a dam, or he was building a bridge someplace, or some kind of chemical plant or an oil refinery. And he could spend a lot of time by himself. Later on in my life, and he wasn't around when I was a kid, he really couldn't take too much intimacy. He just couldn't stand it. And so he had to spend time by himself. It was a way he had of just surviving. Now, I know that he was lonely because later on, after I split up with my first wife a long time ago, I was around 25, and wasn't doing too well emotionally, I moved in with him. And we spent several months together before I moved out again and restarted my life up again. But I noticed with him that he had an aura about him, and I never knew him very well at all since he wasn't there when I was a kid. But I discovered that he had an aura about him of just terrible loneliness. I mean, he just emanated loneliness. There was like a wall around him. And I can't ever say, and my mother was the same way. So both my parents were loners, and I think a loner or loners create loneliness. Now, I've known all of this stuff. There's a difference between being alone and being lonely, like I say. And then there's solitude. Solitude is often something I think that people choose, and I think it's something people need. You could call it alone time, or you could just call it solitude, something people really have to have sometimes, because there's just people are just sort of overwhelmed with crowds. They're overwhelmed with crowds. There are how many? 7.5 billion people in the world. Now, I know, depending on where you live, it's a different story. I mean, you could live way out in the country, or you could live in a house by yourself, or live in a house with your family way off somewhere in the boondocks. But having spent most of my life in a city, I know what it's like to be surrounded by people all the time. And yet you could be lonely in a crowd. You can be lonely in a crowd. I think it all has to do with an internal feeling, an internal identification, a feeling of being able to endure being lonely because you have yourself, because you have a self to fall back on. I remember the best times in my life, the times when I felt the best. I always needed loneliness. Both my parents were loners, but My mother was a complex case. And I'm talking about this based on the theory of how you're brought up. If you think back on the way your parents were, I'm a big believer in the way you were brought up. You know, I'm sure people are born a certain way, you know, like, you know, people are born more or less social. Some people seem to always need to be with other people, and some people seem to need a lot of time alone. I've always needed a lot of time alone. And maybe it was just pure habit, because I was forced to be alone a lot when I was a kid. Since my father was gone and my mother was a loner and stayed by herself and couldn't stand to interact with her own kids, couldn't stand to interact with hardly anybody, I got used to being alone. I had a room of my own up in an attic. not like something like I was stuffed in there, you know, like some crazy uncle. But that's just the way the house was. You know, my sister had a bedroom downstairs near my mother's bedroom. And I had an attic bedroom. So I was sort of up these stairs, like in a tower by myself a lot. And we didn't have much of a family life. You know, there was no tight-knit family life. So basically, I spent a lot of time with myself alone. And I guess it became a habit. It became a habit. I got to the point where being with people in too close quarters was always hard, and still is always hard for me. No matter how close I've ever been to anybody, there's always a part of me that needs to, you know, a little bell goes off after about half an hour, an hour, maybe an hour, 2 hours, where I have to get gone. I have to get off by myself. And, you know, I need that. I need that to repair myself, to regenerate myself. But I've known all these kinds of different states. When I've been feeling my worst in my life, when I've been feeling my worst, when I was feeling the least value of myself, when I was feeling the most empty in my life, is when I couldn't tolerate being alone. What is it that they say in AA, I think, right? Don't be too lonely, too hungry, or too tired. Don't get too lonely, too hungry, or too tired. When I have felt the most shaky or the most unable to rely on my own self, that's when I couldn't stand being alone. I couldn't stand it for 5 minutes. But at the same time, in a contradictory way, I needed time alone. I was overstimulated by other people. I have a niece who works with people there are people who are born a certain way that they can't stand the same kind of stimuli that other people can take. They can't stand the same kind of stimuli. Their nervous system is such that they're born a certain way, and it's structured so that sounds and sights and smells and tastes and anything that has to do with your five senses, they can't stand it. They can't take what other people can endure. And so they have to be trained. They have to be taught how to endure this overstimulus. Myself, again, when I've been feeling my worst, my most unbalanced, is when I feel the same way. I do feel as if sometimes sounds are too loud, and I have felt that lights are too bright, that kind of thing. But when I feel my best, you know, I can endure it. But still, living in a city is unnatural, and living in a crowded, noisy city is crazy. I don't understand how people do it. I live in Manhattan, in a section of Manhattan which is extremely crowded. It's an extremely crowded. I mean, most of Manhattan is crowded, but this is an extremely crowded place. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of people that live in what's called my neighborhood, the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And all you have to do is walk out the front door of your apartment building, and buses and trucks and cars and horns and sirens and hundreds, if not thousands of people. You walk one block, you walk 10 blocks, you might pass several hundred people. And people are talking, and people are yelling, and people are playing their car radios. And it's, to me, generally very overwhelming. But if you're a loner, I think also probably you can't stand this extra stimulus. You can't take this too much stimulus. But when I've been feeling my best, you know, when I'm feeling sort of confident and I'm feeling like I have a solid self or a relatively solid self, the noise doesn't bother me as much. But so all these things, I think, go together. And once again, these people who have been alone too much and have maybe been abused or neglected, they're the ones who turn into loners. I mean, what is a loner exactly? What is a loner? Do you consider yourself a loner? What is it, 25% roughly of American households are single households? I guess that means the elderly who live by themselves, a lot of that. And then there's a lot of people who, single people who live by themselves. And so they have to set up artificial ways to meet. They have to set up circles of friends. They have to set up, there are dating services, ways to meet people. People set up social clubs. People set up, you know, senior centers because there are too many people spending time alone. I mean, people are social animals. People really are social animals. I mean, if you think of cave dwellers and, you know, ancient cave, people who lived in caves, it was a necessity. You had to rely on other people. You may not have liked them or not, but you had to rely on other people. And you probably had a little territory, a little circle inside your cave where that was your personal space, or maybe your mate or your children's personal space. And other people paid attention to that. But people had to depend on each other or else they wouldn't have survived. You know, they had to hunt in packs and they had to protect themselves in packs. And also, you know, the same with villages and tribal areas and then even neighborhoods now. But city life can be so overwhelming. City life is so overwhelming. It's as if you don't have any borders. People could walk right through you and right up to you and right into you. And you feel like you're just being overwhelmed, absolutely overwhelmed. I mean, you could be alone in a crowd. You can be alone in a crowd. You can just be in a big city and find yourself a space, whether you need it or not. You can find yourself a space, particularly if you actually need some time and space to be by yourself. So solitude, loneliness, and aloneness. Solitude, loneliness, and aloneness. I think solitude is something that people choose. And I think aloneness is something people need sometimes. And loneliness is not something anybody wants. Loneliness is not something anybody wants. Let's go to the Otis Redding.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. 'Cause I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. What 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Yes, sitting here resting my bones, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. Listen, 2,000 miles I roam, just just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.
But there's some people, you know, and maybe you're one of them, or maybe you know people like this. I've known people like this who cannot be alone. They cannot stand to be alone for 1 minute. They just can't take it. I had a friend, a couple of friends who split up temporarily or in some cases permanently, you know, and with their wife or their husband. And they didn't have a lot of friends. They didn't have a lot of friends. And they just couldn't stand it. They could not stand to be alone. And people, even people who live with other people, I know they can't take it. They're always with. And for me, from my point of view, it's a great thing to be very social, because I'm kind of antisocial, or I should say not antisocial so much as unsocial. Not that I don't know how to be with people. It's just that I sort of wound up in my life, structuring my life, and just to protect myself, because I was, you know, my mother was a kind of a, what you would call somebody, a no respecter of boundaries. And although she was a loner, when she used to go from one extreme to the other. I mean, when she wasn't alone, she was practically knocking on your head and trying to reach inside your body or something. She was very, very disturbed that way. So I grew up with a complex feeling of being alone and then sort of overwhelmed at the same time. So I, you know, always wanted to be with people and always want to be with people, but I never really formed a circle of friends, never joined any teams or any groups like that or any, you know, I couldn't stand being in crowds. And I was never a member of any teams. I never had a real circle of friends. And I envy people who have that. I absolutely envy people who have that. There's this song by Barbara Streisand, which I could never stand for various reasons, called "People Who Need People." Doesn't everybody need people? Are the luckiest people in the world? I could never take that song for various reasons. But I've had friends who couldn't stand to be alone for 1 second. They were scared to be alone. And like I say, there have been times in my life, I don't know if this goes for you too, but there have been times in my life when I was scared to be alone, when just even being alone for a few minutes was just unbearable for me. I felt like I was in some kind of terrible danger and I couldn't handle it. But there have been other times when being alone was perfectly fine with me. But I've known people who could never stand to be alone ever. They couldn't just, you know, if they were alone for 1 minute, they would have to leave their house. They would have to be on, now people would be on Skype every minute. They would be on the phone with somebody else. It looks as if when you look at people with these devices, you know, their smartphones and people, is there Skyping now on smartphones? I really don't know. Can people actually Skype on smartphones? I know they can. Oh, they can. Yes. I just, good. I'm in touch. I'm in touch from my solitude in my living room here with my engineer, who tells me you can Skype on smartphones. So now you don't ever really have to be alone. Technically, people are always in touch with these people with each other all the time. But there are people who can't stand to be alone. There are other people who can't stand ever to be with people at all, like monks, you know, like people who go off and live in caves, or people who seem to choose anyhow to be isolated from other people. I never think it's a choice. I think people do this because of the way they were brought up, or because of the way society is structured a certain way. Some people can't. Some people can't handle being with other people, but they want to be. But think of people who go off by themselves to be monks, or people who live in places where they are, where they have vows of silence. Still, they're with other people. I mean, that's an interesting combination too. I mean, do such places exist anymore? I guess they do. Monasteries where people live with other people, but they live in their own individual cells because, you know, God forbid anything should happen if they're in the same room with somebody else. But they live in their own individual cells. It's just them and God, really, between them and God. And they have a vow of silence, which may be broken sometimes at mealtimes or at prayer times when somebody leads them in prayer or when maybe they're allowed to have some moments where they're not silent. But there are people who cannot take being alone and other people who are the other extreme. Obviously, it's a balance. The balance is what you really want, to be with people and to be able to also have your own time by yourself. If you're with people all the time, if you work in an office all the time, if you work with people, a crowded office, you're on crowded subways in the city. I mean, New York, it's really... You get on, you walk outside on the street, there's a million people. You get, you're on your way to your office or where you work, it's crowded, there are people, you go into some giant office building or some place where you work and there's dozens if not hundreds of people in the place you work and it's busy all the time. There's, you know, you have your cubicle, which is a kind of a insufficient artificial separation. And you, you know, you crave, you need, human beings need to be by themselves sometimes. But I think you get into a habit, too. I mean, I think people are trained to believe that they should be with people all the time. It is frowned upon, I think, sometimes when people, now it's not healthy to be alone too much. But sometimes I think when people who really do want to be alone, I've read poems and read books by people who chose to go live by themselves in a cottage or a cabin even in the country. Take a guy like Thoreau. Now, I think he knew that he was going to, that it was a temporary experiment. He did not intend to live, you know, Walden. You know, he didn't intend to live off in the woods by himself forever. I think it was a kind of deliberate experiment, although I don't really know. I haven't read Walden for a long time. Is that the title of it, Walden or Life in the Woods? I don't remember what the exact title is. But Thoreau writes beautifully about that. If you want to read about somebody who chose solitude and somebody perhaps who needed solitude, Walden is the title. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Engineer. There'll be a little something extra for you this Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever it is. Walden is the title. It's a great book about somebody... You know, it's about everything. It's about human beings, about nature, about our relationship to laws and society. It's about every kind of philosophy. It's about an internal life, about a spiritual life. One of the great books there is, Walden, Life in the Woods by Henry Thoreau. But he went off to be by himself. And I've read other books by people in the modern age who have chosen, a lot of poets and people who have chosen to be who've chosen solitude. Some people I know, I knew a guy who was a partner at a law firm where I was a paralegal who went off by himself. And it was a very, very busy law firm. And he was, you know, he had a very busy social life and he had a big family. He was always with people. And something happened where he had enough of this. And he went off with his family. He went off to the country and, decided to live, you know, very, very far away from people. He had an overload of people. But one thing I could never take was, because I was brought up this way and I need my solitude and I need my my space from people. And I have trouble with intimacy with other people, is I could never stand crowds. And I wonder how many of you are the same way. I mean, I could not stand crowds. I couldn't go to rock concerts. I could never have gone to a place, some gigantic rock concert or some giant gathering. I did participate in demonstrations. I was involved in some demonstrations, and I never liked being in crowds because crowds get out of control so fast. People lose their sense of individuality and their sense of proportion and even morality in crowds. I mean, look at soccer crowds. I just read an article in the paper about how there is a lot of increasingly anti-Semitic behavior, Nazi salutes and anti-Semitic slurs. And it's a growing problem from soccer crowds. And soccer crowds are notoriously famous for being rowdy and and being dangerous. And sometimes when I think of crowds and groups, like, for instance, I could never be in a museum. I couldn't stand to go to a crowded museum. I couldn't stand to go shopping because it was so overwhelming in some big department store, you know, anything like that. Even a restaurant that's a crowded, busy restaurant, I could never take. But I think there's a danger for somebody like me. I think there's a danger in crowds. People who always have to be in a gang or in a crowd or in a giant crowd. When I look at the fans, you know, football fans, you always watch football fans on or soccer fans in the stands when there are games on TV. Or maybe you've been to them. Maybe you could stand that. I could never take that. But people will act any way in a crowd. I mean, they will get carried away. I mean, the extreme version of that, I think, is, you know, those Nazi rallies, those gigantic Nazi rallies and those huge Soviet rallies, where to be an individual is seen as a bad thing, to want to be by yourself, to be an individual, to go off and live your own life, to have a separate existence from anybody else is seen as antisocial, even probably illegal practically. People are suspect if you're not acting like everybody else, these corporate crowds. And I think we all have these feelings. We grow up in America in a place where we have more choice over what we want to be. And we have a kind of, we're repelled by these, by the extremity and the crazy behavior of these huge crowds of people all doing the same thing because of the ultimate outcome of what that could be like. I mean, a little example of that is, can we get that beer hall music? You hear this kind of stuff, and you've seen like documentaries of this, and maybe you've been to beer fests. They have these, I think, in upstate New York sometimes, and different places in the country, they have where there's a German population, they have these beer fests. I don't know. Have you ever been to Germany and gone to a beer fest? I have not. But you have this vision of all these people with this kind of crowd mentality, this corporate exuberance, that they could get completely carried away, a sense that if you want to sit by yourself and have a drink, just to be quiet and just to be contemplative, you would be considered not only just antisocial, but almost like a danger to the rest of the group. You know, there are places where it's considered to be that way. On the other hand, what little I've read of the behavior of American Indians was that they were completely tolerant. I mean, obviously they had to live a life which was kind of tribal for survival, for the necessity of survival. But if somebody wanted to go off by themselves because they felt the need to do that, if somebody didn't want to be bothered, maybe within you know, within the circle of the community, they could just wander off or just walk off a certain distance. And people respected the fact that they needed this time alone. I think people, spiritual people, do need time alone. Who needs time alone is artists. I can't, except for people who work in a collaborative way. I mean, people who work in dance troupes, people who work, you know, composers and lyricists, people who work together, musical groups, performing groups, any kind of group artistic behavior. But somebody has to come up with the concept of it. And you can't come up, in my experience, with this kind of thing. Like I can do something like tell a story on the radio, like I used to tell stories on the radio or in performance. And I usually worked as a monologist, being the kind of person who needed to be alone and needed solitude of a certain kind, just out of habit or because I needed it, because I felt for my emotional survival. You know, I did my own, you know, thing, but I did it. I was a performer, and I'm performing when I'm on the radio. But to come up with the story, I had to have solitude. I think people who are artists, who are composing songs, or who are certainly people, painters, people who are composing music, people who are, you know, sculpting, you don't do this as a social activity. You don't do this as a social activity. If you come up with if you write a screenplay, you could write it with somebody else, but you're a part of it. When you're generating your own, part of it, you have to have time alone. I've never really heard of anybody who was genuinely artistic, who could do this kind of thing in a group, in a crowd. I see people all the time with their laptops in places, you know, like Starbucks, that are doing this, and I wonder what they're writing. Maybe people are different than they used to be. Maybe people can actually write a novel in Starbucks. I don't know, but anybody who I've ever known who was a writer had to have time by themselves. Now I know people who go to places because they don't like to be alone too much, and because they feel the stimulus of other artists working in the same place. There are writers, places where people go to write, and they have their own separate cubicles, and everybody's very quiet. Everybody respects everybody else's solitude, but it's right next to somebody else. It's right next to somebody else. So I think what you're getting is the best of both worlds in that way, because I have a friend, for instance, who's a novelist, who's written several novels and written several books, and he needs to be able to concentrate, but he likes to be around other people. He doesn't like to be absolutely alone. And yet I've known other people who couldn't possibly compose a book, or couldn't write poetry, or couldn't write a novel unless they were completely alone, had that complete solitude to work in. And then there's the solitude of groups. When people, like, did you ever go to a Quaker meeting? That's the most interesting thing. I think sometimes people can find this solitude. This is a perfect blending or balance of what I'm talking about here today, as much as I can identify what I'm talking about, to try to put my finger on it. This is just pure talking out loud here today. To worship in groups, but to worship in silence. Obviously, there are, you know, people who pray and sing hymns and, you know, gospel together and make a lot of racket, a joyful noise unto the Lord, you know, together. And I can see that. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to get together with other people and to experience this kind of joy together with other people. Not something I've ever really done, or something I think maybe that I would even be capable of doing. But I always envy people who can do this. But the most interesting thing I've ever seen, and something that's almost impossibly hard to deal with, if you've ever been to a Quaker meeting, Raise your hand. Anybody out there ever been to a Quaker meeting? It's really extraordinary. You go there and you're just utterly silent. It's in a square. People are seated in a square, sort of facing inwards into the center of the square. After some remarks or some comments by the leader of the group, everybody just sits there and says nothing, says absolutely nothing. If you want to say something, then you just sit, you just stand up and you utter a feeling or a spiritual thought or some moment that some revelation that has occurred to you, a personal revelation or something you feel, and it's a personal thing, something that you felt, something that has to do with God or other people, or something that has to do with wars or whatever huge subject is troubling everybody at the time. And you say what you have to say, and everybody maintains this respectful silence. And then you sit down, and other people don't stand up and argue with you. There's not a dialogue that goes on particularly. And you say what you have to say because the Spirit has moved you. When you sit there, you're in communion with a what would be called a higher power or your higher self or something, whatever connects you to the eternal. And then the Spirit may move you, or it may not, and you don't say anything. But if the Spirit moves you, you would stand up and say something. And then you sit down. And it's an extraordinary experience for somebody who's who's sort of itchy like I am. I've been to several Quaker meetings in my life at different times in my life. And I found them very difficult to endure. The silence was difficult for me to endure. But of late, and off and on in my life, but lately I've been doing this more, I go to meditation groups. I've been going to meditation groups. And it's really quite a wonderful experience. I love this experience where people sit together and there's a leader, and sometimes the leader speaks and sometimes they don't. And you can sit for as much in this group as a half hour. Now, I meditate at home sometimes by myself, and I do sometimes find it a lonely experience when I'm by myself, or sometimes I find it just a wonderful experience, just to sit there and breathe. And just my thoughts flow, and then they flow out, they come in, they go out. I don't attach myself to any particular impulse or any particular thought. And I'm alone when I'm meditating. And I think people get something from this. But to meditate with a group of people, and I think I know there's people who've written to me, listeners who've written to me, who do meditate with other people. And it's quite extraordinary. The leader of the group will start off. Everybody sits in this group, the meditation group I go to. Everybody sits in an oval, a large oval. Maybe there's 15 to sometimes as many as 25 people sitting in an oval. And you sit in a certain position where you're relaxed, but you're alert. And the leader of the group will start off and talk about, introduce anybody who hasn't been to meditation before to tell you what it's about and to explain. There's different kinds of meditation. In this case, it's something called mindfulness meditation, where you just pay attention, you just breathe. The anchor for you is your breath. And what you do is you just concentrate on your breath. Now, your mind never stops working. What the Buddhists call it, they call it a monkey mind. Your mind never stops jumping from one branch to another. It reviews the past. It worries about what's going on, about 10 things at once. It worries about the future. But when you're sitting there in meditation, the point is there's nothing you can do about any of these things. You're sitting in a place, you turn your cell phone off, there's no communication, and you just sit there and you're with other people. But it's the experience of being by yourself with other people around you, which is very similar to the experience I had at Quaker meetings. So to sum up today, what I'm getting at is that there is a difference between being alone and between loneliness and being alone. And certainly there's solitude too, which unfortunately sometimes is imposed on people, like solitary. But a lot of people choose solitude, and people have more or less need for being alone and for solitude. These days, I think in society, and it's one of the great ironies of modern society in a city, that although there are millions of people, for instance, in New York City, there are also several hundred thousand people who at any time would identify themselves as lonely, as isolated in this city. In my apartment building, there's 180 apartments in my apartment building. Something like 350 people live here. And yet there could be people, and there are people, who live by themselves alone in their apartments. It's an extraordinary thing. So loners, if somebody's a loner, obviously what's needed is a balance. You got to be with people, and then you need time alone. And Jean-Paul Sartre once said, hell is other people. But the problem is, and the good part about it is also heaven is other people too. Well, that's all for this week. I'll see you next week.
When you're down and troubled and you need some love and care and nothing is going. You've got a friend.